The Bleacher Briefing Podcast. All sports topics, all the time. What is up, ladies and gentlemen, and welcome to another edition of the Bleacher Briefing Podcast. I'm your host, Chris Fletcher, and joining me, as always, co-host from WNSR Nashville, Mr. Timothy Swift. How you doing, Tim?
Doing outstanding, Chris. Doing outstanding.
Good to hear, my man. Good to hear. As always, we got a packed show for everyone this week. Let's jump right into it here. I want to kick off the broadcast with some college basketball talk. The NCAA tournament now in full swing, and they don't call it March Madness for nothing. Already down to the Sweet 16. Obviously, some teams still alive that many people expected to still be standing at this point. In fact, all of our picks for the Final Four are still in it, Tim. Also, several surprises reaching the field of 16. In several shows throughout the course of the last few months, we've said that this year's tournament had the potential to be one of the wildest in recent memory. And it's been just that, hasn't it, Tim? What's your overall assessment of the first weekend of tournament play?
Yeah, it was a general feeling of you thought it was going to be chaos, and it has been. The first game on Thursday, the Ohio State-Dayton game, several of my coworkers and I were sitting around in the studio before one of the shows, and we're watching that game, and after Dayton wins, we all kind of look at each other like, this is what it's going to be like.
Yep.
and we were not disappointed. You had all those overtime games on Thursday, had a few great games on Friday. So really just the tenor of the whole 4 days was outstanding and pretty chaotic when it came down to it.
Several things we want to take a closer look at as it pertains to the tourney. Let's start with Wichita State and Kentucky. Wildcats knocking off the previously unbeaten Shockers on Sunday, 78-76, the final there. And Tim, you talked about Kentucky at length last week and what their potential prognosis was heading into the NCAAs. Been all over the map this season with the way they've performed. Obviously a very talented bunch, but very young as well. Hard to really get a handle on how they will execute from one game to the next. But I think it's pretty safe to say now that this team plays down, or in Sunday's case, up to their level of competition, don't they, Tim? And if it's a team they should get by fairly easily, they tend to just kind of go through the motions and in a lot of cases sleepwalk through the contest. But when John Calipari's boys are looked at as the underdogs or the inferior team, they elevate their play, and they can hang with virtually anybody, can't they?
Well, obviously, we talked about it last week. They have top-level NBA talent, especially across that front line.
Yep.
Randall was great the first two games. The Harrison twins, and that was the big thing and the big concern I had last weekend when I thought Kentucky would slip up in the first weekend, is because I thought the guard play wasn't going to be very good enough, and I thought the Harrison twins were at the center of that. Well, on Sunday, they were absolutely brilliant. I've seen them play in person, and I did not see that performance in them on Sunday. So I think the biggest thing there was the guard play was elevated. Julius Randle was his normal brilliant self. You got other contributions across that front line from Poitras and Cauley-Stein. So it was a total team effort. But let's be honest, Kentucky should have never been in that spot in the first place. Remember, this is a team you talked about as a possible number one, number one at the beginning of the year. Everybody was joking about the 40-0 and everything else going on there. So for them to get to this point, they're supposed to be in the Sweet 16. But the path on how they got there, that's the thing that's a little bit troubling. And the inconsistency that they've had all year, I don't know what to expect from them this weekend. You just don't know.
And even though they fell short, props to Wichita State for a great season. Because I think Sunday they proved they were better than a lot of people gave them credit for this year, weren't they, Tim?
Yeah, and it goes back to their outstanding guard play and what they were able to do. And I think the balance was how Wichita State got to be a number one seed.
Yeah.
And I will say this for the people who have downed them because of their schedule. Tell Kansas and Kansas State and Nebraska and other Big 12 teams to get off their you-know-what and schedule them.
Yeah.
Because it's not going to get any better for them if they don't get those games. And it's a shame the teams like that will not play them. To the point, Chris, they're talking about being legislation being passed in the Kansas State House to try to get these three teams to play each other. So everybody who wants to talk about their scheduling, go look at those teams in the Big 12 who avoided them like the plague over the last several years.
A couple of other high seeds that had lofty expectations entering the tournament. Number 2 Kansas in the South region and number 3 Duke in the Midwest both bounced early. Jayhawks knocked off by Stanford in the round of 32, 60-57 the final on that one. and Duke dropped in their opening game 78-71, falling to number 14 Mercer, who has since been eliminated by another Cinderella team, the Tennessee Vols, which we'll discuss them later in the program. Tim, which of these high-profile schools was a bigger disappointment in your estimation, and what caused their downfalls?
Well, I will say with Kansas, I think they're the bigger disappointment. And, of course, a lot of people are going to lean on the excuse of Joel Embiid being out. And they had played well without him, so I'm not going to use that as an excuse. They should have won that game on Sunday. But there's a prevailing theme with these teams who did not play well that were 2 seeds, 3 seeds, whatever. If you do not bring your guard play every night in the NCAA tournament, that is going to be a huge factor in whether you go home early or not. And Kansas and Duke, in both cases, did not bring their guard play. And I will say this for Duke also. This is a recurring problem with them as far as why they're losing these, you know, games to Mercer or Lehigh. Their interior defense, Chris, the last 5 years, we're going a full class plus a year, it's been terrible. And even the national championship they won a few years ago, they got away with outstanding offense. But that interior defense, if they want to get back to where Duke fans expect them to be, they've got to get bigger on the interior, and they've got to be better on the interior. It's great that they've got flashy wing scores and they've got great shooters, but again, sometimes you need guys to be able to pack the paint, block shots, get key rebounds, and Duke has not been able to do that over the last few years.
Andrew Wiggins, Jabari Parker, among the young NCAA talent bounced early. Are these guys NBA ready, or do they need to stay put? Basically a rhetorical question, by the way. But will they enter the draft, or will they be back at their respective schools next season, you think?
I mean, obviously, I think both of them are going to be gone, but I am a lot more concerned about Wiggins, because even throughout the season, Wiggins would float in and out of games. There were Kansas games I would watch in January and February, and we would you'd go 5 or 6 minutes, and you'd be like, oh,
where's he at? Yeah.
At times, you would never sense that he put his imprint on the game. At least I will say for Jabari Parker, even if he was struggling offensively, he would try to find a way to put his imprint on the game, which is why I think he's going to be the number one pick. But if you know, you're a guy who's looking at Wiggins, that's something that's got to concern you.
Yeah.
Because you can't hide in the NBA, and you can't just kind of float out there. And in the situation where his team needed him, 4 points and four turnovers is not good enough.
Of the 16 teams remaining, who do you think is playing the best basketball right now, Tim? Meaning, if you're one of the other 15 squads still in this tournament, who are you not wanting to face moving forward?
Well, I'm going to go with the obvious pick. It's Florida.
Yeah.
I mean, defensively right now, they are completely and utterly in a zone defensively. And I'm talking about communication and you know, switching out on ball screens and guys going to the glass, and just they are in harmony on defense. And it's tough to find that with college kids or 18, 20 years old. But because you have a senior-laden team like Florida does, defensively, I just think right now, and they're getting enough offense. Again, Florida was never at any point this year going to blow you away with 80, 85-point
games. They don't have to.
Yeah, it's efficient enough to where it doesn't matter. Yeah. So right now, it's still Florida, and there's a reason why they were the number one pick.
Lastly, still three double-digit seeds alive in this thing. Dayton, an 11 seed, and Stanford, a 10 seed, actually face each other on Thursday. And Tennessee still in it as an 11 seed, taking on number 2 Michigan Friday. Of these three teams, Cinderellas, if you will, which one poses the biggest threat the rest of the way and why?
Oh, it's easily Tennessee. And I went back and I tried to find it, and I listened to it briefly. I had mentioned Tennessee in the college basketball preview because I thought they had an NBA front line, which not a lot of teams have. Now, their guard play, again, been all over the place, which is precisely why they were playing in one of the first four games in the first place, because they almost didn't make the tournament because their shooting and their guard play was so bad throughout the season. But when you've got Maven and Stokes inside, and those two guys who – even if they miss shots in the interior, can just get their own rebound. And most college kids are not strong enough to deal with those two in a manner. So they'll miss 2, 3, 4 shots. It won't matter. Their rebounding is what got them here. And I think it could extend their season a couple more games. Fascinating stat about their game against Mercer on Sunday. Mercer had 4 rebounds in the first half. 4. So it just tells you, even if Tennessee is missing shots, they're going to clean the glass, and I think that makes them a lot more dangerous than those other two teams.
Shifting our attention to the NBA now, and the sad state of the Philadelphia 76ers, losers of 25 straight games following Monday's loss to the San Antonio Spurs. Philly has not won a game since January 29th, As a reminder, we are now in the final week of March. And they are just a game away from tying the Cleveland Cavaliers for most consecutive defeats, a dubious distinction they set back in 2010, the season after LeBron left town. The Sixers could tie said record Thursday with a loss in Houston and could take sole possession of it Saturday with a loss at home to the Pistons. Tim, we've talked about the 76ers in the past and how they essentially started tanking this season back last summer, but this is getting pretty sad now, isn't it? So two questions. Do they break this record? And if they hit 27, when will this exercise in futility mercifully come to an end? Will they win another game this year? Put all this in some perspective for us.
You know what, Chris? I'll be honest. I don't think they're going to win another game this year. And when people started mentioning that 2 or 3 weeks ago, I was like, no, it's the NBA. Somebody will slip up. But, Chris, an amazing thing's happened over the last 2 or 3 weeks when teams play Philadelphia. They don't want to be the team.
Yep.
Shockingly enough, teams, whether they have 20 wins or they're competing for a title like a Miami or the...
We're not losing to y'all.
Yeah, it's a weird thing, Chris. They actually elevate their game.
Yep.
In that game that you mentioned about that they played the Spurs on Monday night, I watched part of that game, and at one point in the game, you could tell Greg Popovich is like, no, we're not going to be the team that does this. And at some point in the second and third quarter, the Spurs played some brilliant basketball, and you're thinking to yourself, this is almost becoming a motivational tool. No one wants to be that team who loses to them. I don't think it happens this year, just to be perfectly honest with you. You look into the schedule, they still have Houston on there. They still have Miami on there. The teams that are playing for something. So I could really see this streak going all the way to the end of the season. And what's so amazing about this, after all of these games lost, Chris, 25 in a row, they're still not the worst.
Yeah.
We ought to tell you something about Milwaukee Bucks and the competition this year in the association. But, yeah, it's amazing in one way. You almost feel bad for them another way. But, yeah, I don't really think this streak ends this year.
Going to take some emails now. And for anyone out there who would like to be a part of future shows, if you got a question or comment, drop us a line at thebleacherbriefings@inbox.com. And we will be sure to get to those and possibly read them during a future broadcast. And this first email comes from Charles Duggar out of Savannah, Georgia. And Charles writes, the Heat have been struggling lately. Do you guys think there is cause for concern in Miami? Heat are 5-8 in their last 13 games and have actually lost 5 more games than they did all last season already and still have 13 games remaining on their schedule. The way I see it, under normal circumstances, I would say there's no real cause for concern simply because they're the two-time defending champions, and obviously there's going to be situations where they may get complacent over the course of an 82-game season. But here's the issue. They're playing poorly down the home stretch, which is hard to spin in a positive way. And Coach Spoelstra has been forced to use 18 different variations of his lineup throughout the course of this season, with guys missing games with injuries and so forth. So their starters haven't really had long stretches of playing together to get in any real kind of rhythm, and that's certainly not something you're still looking for once the postseason gets underway. At the end of the day, they're still the Heat, still the two-time defending champions, still have the best player on the planet, LeBron James, but I don't think it's necessarily a given that they three-peat now, and Tim, you and I both picked them back in our NBA preview show to win it all. I'm not anywhere near as comfortable saying that now as I was back in October. What say you?
Yeah, I'm not that comfortable either, and I'll look at this a couple of different ways from a philosophy standpoint. One of the big things defensively that Miami did over the last 2 years, especially in the playoffs, was when a big guy would set that screen and roll 20, 25 feet from the basket, whoever was the big was agile enough to blitz that point guard and scare him into turnovers. And there was a lot of that going on. There was a lot of on-the-ball turnovers that Miami was forcing over the last 2 years that they're not doing. The other thing is I checked out some box scores just from the games in March, and this is going to be a long list. Bear with me for a second. These are all of the guys over the last 13 games that have had double-doubles. You're talking Kenneth Faried. Dwight Howard's done it twice. Zach Randolph, Anthony Davis, Al Jefferson, Tim Duncan, Kyle O'Quinn, Joakim Noah, Anderson Varejão, and Marcin Gortat. That's only 2 games that a big guy did not have a double-double against Miami over the last month. We've talked about the rebounding before, and it's been a problem,
yep,
but it's a real problem. It's even a bigger problem now. I think in the past, because of the way they could force turnovers, they can max, kind of cover up the rebounding issues. But it feels like even the most average big man, Chris, gets 20 and 10
yep.
when they go to South Beach. And that's a real problem going into the playoffs, where you're going to be seeing guys who have some skills, especially if they get to the finals. A lot of those teams that, they're going to be out in the West are going to have a 4 or a 5 that's going to be punishing them down low. So I'm not nearly as confident as I was in November about picking Miami. They're still the defending champions, but there are some real issues that can get exploited in the playoffs.
If Dwayne Wade is not at or near 100%, can the Heat three-peat?
No, not at all. And because of the interior issues, Dwayne Wade has to be a 20-point, 50% from the field, 5 or 6 rebounds, 5 or 6 assist guy every single night in the playoffs.
Yep.
If the interior defense and the rebounding is not going to get any better, Wade's got to bring those type of numbers each night, or Miami's not going to win.
But thanks for the email, Charles. And this next email comes from Jason Eiler. Hopefully I'm pronouncing that correctly. It's E-I-L-E-R, out of Rochester, New York. And Jason writes, "The Jets released Mark Sanchez over the weekend and signed Michael Vick. What do you think of the moves? Sanchez released by the Jets on Friday, ending his 5-year turbulent stint with the club. Vick signed shortly thereafter. In an ironic twist, the Eagles, Vick's former team, are now reportedly interested in signing Sanchez. Some reports Monday saying that it was already a done deal, but no official word yet from either the Eagles or Sanchez. What do you think, Tim?"
I think it's a fine deal for the Jets. It's a 1-year deal. You're not really asking Vick to come in and play 16 games and throw the ball 500 times. This is not realistic at this point in his career. And actually, it's never been realistic because he's never really done it. But it also speaks to the impatience that now we judge quarterbacks. And I know Geno Smith was terrible last year, the 12 touchdowns, only 21 and the 21 interceptions. But essentially, you're giving all these rookie quarterbacks, they're not going to always be Andrew Luck and step in day one and perform. So you are putting pressure on these guys to say, hey, you got 10, 12, 14 games, essentially, even as a high draft pick. And if it does not work out, we will immediately look for your replacement
yep.
or temporary replacement. So I think it puts a lot of pressure on Geno Smith. I know he's saying all the right things right now, talking about Michael Vick, his guy, and all of that. But we'll see how it feels in September when he has that 3 or 4 interception game, because it's probably going to happen. And then Vick steps in and is magical for a game or two. And then you've got another quarterback controversy on your hands. And looking back at some numbers, I think nowadays, because the pressure to win is so great and these GMs and coaches know, they don't care about quarterback development anymore. If it's not going to work, get a new guy in there. You're talking about Peyton Manning, one of the greatest quarterbacks of all time. I looked up, in his fourth year, the Colts were 10, and he had 23 picks. If you were to do that now as a rookie, you may not get a second shot. And he did that in his fourth year. It just kind of speaks to where these guys are in this win now mode. And it wasn't always like that. It was just as recently as 10 years ago.
Obviously, Sanchez's run in New York was over, and no one was really surprised that he was given his walking papers. But the Jets had to get some viable competition in camp, because you would be hard-pressed to find anyone that would go on record saying Geno Smith is a stone-cold lock as far as long-term solution at the quarterback position goes, given the way he performed last season, as you referenced. I mean, the guy was a turnover machine. Granted, a lot of that had to do with the level of talent around him, which, for that matter, Mark Sanchez can point the finger at the same thing, because it's not like he was taking the field with a stellar supporting cast when he's played the last few years either. Is Michael Vick the long-term solution? Obviously not, but Vick has shown, when he's healthy, and that's the key there, that he's capable of winning some games in the National Football League. Now, is he as dynamic of a player as he was, say, 7 or 8 years ago? Of course not. He's 33 years old now. But would I be surprised if he's under center for the Jets week one this season? No, I wouldn't. I guess my point is, they could have done a lot worse than Michael Vick. And I guess we're going to see what Geno Smith is really made of once camp opens and the preseason gets underway. But thanks for the email, Jason. And this last email comes from Robert Webb out of Bloomington, Illinois. And Robert writes, "Do you guys think Roddy White should pay up on the Twitter bet he made with a fan?" For those that missed it, the Falcons receiver said on the social media platform before the NCAA tournament that Duke would claim the national title. When a fan challenged White by saying the Blue Devils would fail to advance beyond the round of 64 against number 14 seed Mercer, White tweeted he would buy the fan Falcons season tickets on the 50-yard line if he was correct. Well, he was right. Duke lost. After the game, White acknowledged the bet, but said he will only give the fan tickets to one game, tweeting, "I lost a bet, and I will give him tickets to the Bears game since he's also a Bears fan. Done with this bet." White went on to say people who think he should pay with the full season tickets are, quote, crazy, tweeting, "Y'all people are crazy. You want me to man up and pay a bet to a person that had nothing to lose in the bet? Hashtag sounds ridiculous." Do I think he should be on the hook for season tickets as opposed to just a single game? Absolutely. Why? Because White is the one that put it out there to begin with. The fan, whose name is Dylan Hoyt, by the way, didn't ask White to bet. He didn't raise any kind of stakes on the game. He simply said Duke was getting bounced, and then White made the statement. So don't type it up and push tweet if you have no intentions of actually backing up what you say. It was stupid on his part to go that route to begin with. And to me, this is further proof that athletes just need to stay off social media in general, because once it's out there, it's not going away. Even if you delete it, somebody's already screen-capped it or whatever, and you're on the hook. Of course, as journalists, people in this business, we love it because it gives us something to talk about. But little good comes out of athletes having Twitter accounts and things of that nature. But yeah, dude should be getting season tickets at the 50-yard line, not this one-game crap. What do you think, Tim?
You know what? Roddy White is missing a golden opportunity to nail a PR move. And what do I mean by that? How about you get him the tickets? You fly him to Atlanta. You give him a tour of the facility. You make a big deal out of it. And guess what? All the front pages will be like, "Roddy White, good guy. Pays up on bet." Simple as that. It's not about the money. Let's get that very clear right now. It's not about the money.
Yeah, he ain't slumming it.
Yeah. If he understood PR,
which he clearly doesn't,
out there and done all this and made a big deal, took a picture with the tickets, you know, kind of
big grand,
let him meet other Falcons, then he has an experience of a lifetime, and Roddy White looks like a good guy. Instead, now he looks like a jerk who's kind of welching on a bet. So, in a sense, that somebody should have gotten Roddy White's ear and said, "Man, you know what? Just pay the tickets. We'll take care of it. It's a PR opportunity. You can look good. That's a little, you know, if you do something bad, people will look back like, well, Roddy White's a pretty good guy." Instead, he went this route, and I don't agree with it at all. You're right, Chris. He made the bet. He reached out to Spud, and then this guy was right.
But thanks for the email, Robert. And again, for anyone out there who would like to be a part of future shows, if you've got a question or comment, drop us a line at thebleacherbriefings@inbox.com, and we will be sure to get to those. But we're going to get ready to get out of here. Be sure to catch us at thebleacherbriefings.com. You can also follow us on Facebook and Twitter. There are links to both on the actual website. Just click on the follow tab and it'll take you to those. And don't forget, our podcasts are also available on iTunes, so be sure to check those out and take us with you when you go. That's going to do it for us. I'm your host, Chris Fletcher. For Tim Swift, thanks for tuning in, and we will see you next week.